Okay, is this still working? Can you hear me? Is it sound about right? Okay. I kind of enjoyed hearing the AA meeting. Sound like they were having fun. It reminded me of, for a while in Santa Cruz, we had a once a week, a 12 to 1 meditation across from a school. And at 12:30, they let all the kids out. And it kind of was like that. Yeah. A lot of laughing and playful sound. I also wanted to thank Shyla and the board and anyone who was responsible for inviting me here tonight. So. Thank you very much. And I want to let people know I was actually at the Berry Center of Buddhist Studies at the end of June, and I saw Shiloh wandering around quietly. And she looked well, so just so you know. So my talk tonight is called The Practice of the Wild, and I signed up for this last year. I normally choose the topic of my talk like the day I'm going to give a talk, so it's kind of funny to have this on the docket for so long. Of course, I didn't necessarily haven't been preparing since then, but I realized as I was reflecting on what I wanted to talk about tonight that this was my second time teaching here, and I was trying to remember what I talked about then, and I actually have no memory. I have a very clear memory of being here, but if anybody was here when I talked, maybe you remember what I talked about, but I was actually quite sick, and I think that led to my amnesia, but it occurred to me that maybe I had this, similar talk that night, because I know about that time, it was a couple years ago, I also gave a similar talk to them tonight. So if I'm giving the same talk, it's not the same talk because I've rewritten it, but the same topic, hopefully it will be still interesting if you heard it before, or more interesting or useful in some way. I want to say I do give what I call normal Dharma talks on regular Dharma topics. This one's a little different than the regular teaching on the regular Dharma teachings. And this is, as I understand it, part of a series on Buddhism, kind of Dharma, Buddhism in American culture. And I picked this topic as because it's a particular interest, really passion of mine. I could also say it's maybe a mission of mine, which might come through as I'm talking. And because I thought nobody else would pick this topic. I looked at the list on the website and it looked like a nice, really interesting variety in this series. So I actually I guess I could go online and hear the other ones. I haven't been to the other ones. And maybe I'll just add, since choosing to speak about this here tonight, I've actually started some preliminary efforts to write a book on this topic. So even tonight is helping me find out what's most important to talk about for you, for the people I'm trying to reach. And I hope you go away tonight from tonight's talk I was thinking about the day. Well, what do I want people to get out of this talk tonight, and what would be nice? And one can never predict that, but I would hope that people might feel some inspiration to reflect upon, or some curiosity in exploring more this idea of Dharma practice in nature, through nature, with nature, with really the natural world as the teacher of Dharma, of perhaps creating more time in your life to very consciously allow time in nature to be part of your practice in an overt way. It may already be part of your practice, but you've never really named it as such. My experience with people in general, and certainly in California and the Bay Area, that being outdoors and in nature is an important part of one's life. And I'm hoping that this will also encourage you to discover on deeper and deeper levels the potential power of practice in the natural world to take you deeper into your process of awakening and healing. And one way I like to think of it is I hope it will inspire you to think out of the box, to practice out of the box. And I mean that sort of literally. We live in boxes. This is a big box we're in tonight. And I practice, I teach mostly in these boxes called buildings. But there's a possibility to do what one friend who teaches outdoors calls meditation without walls. And it's been a for me, it's been a major part of my own practice. And because of that, I found it to be especially transforming and especially impactful. Another friend of mine, and we sometimes teach nature retreats together, she was talking about how it's kind of a double whammy is the way she calls it. That we're going on retreat, on a Dharma retreat, is in itself a powerful experience of deepening practice, of deepening our exploration of who and what we really are. And then when you do that in nature, there's a whole extra layer of depth, maybe, I don't even know how to talk about it, of direct experience, I think, that enhances our journey, our spiritual journey. I remember I've done a lot of different kinds. I might refer to a little bit, a lot of solo work in nature, and I've done 2-month-long solos retreats in Colorado. And I just want to say, I remember, particularly after coming back to the first one, I would come into rooms like this, and I would say, how weird we live in all these buildings, and how strange these things we sit on are, and how uncomfortable and actually unpleasant a lot of it really is. But we've become so used to it as sort of the norm that we don't always recognize how much of what we live in and are engaged in is actually not so conducive to being a animal and a human being. So, considering this is part of a series on Buddhism and American culture, I was thinking, was this is this topic? What does this topic have to do with American culture? And is it part of American culture? What is the overlap here? And I certainly think that it is in certain ways, yes and no. And I also was considering, what is the relationship of practice of the natural world, of understanding our relationship with the natural world, and traditional Buddhist practice and culture? And there's a lot of correlations there. I'm only going to refer to a few things, because really a lot of the things I'm talking about could be whole books or dissertations in themselves, or have been already. But I just a few things I want to say about the place of the natural world in Buddhist practice. There are certainly many stories, examples, teachings from past and present about what I might call Buddhist nature-based awareness practice, as well as actually environmental action, Buddhist environmental action. Some of you may be familiar with that in recent years, some monks in Thailand have taken up the practice of ordaining trees, allowing trees to become monastics. Actually, their intention is really to bring awareness to the forest and to allow the ordaining of trees to prohibit corporations coming in and deforesting and destroying the ecosystems there, which is happening all over the world and certainly happening in Southeast Asia. So there's many interesting things like that going on as well. There's also certainly, many of you may be aware of this, might say a reverence and an understanding of what I call the teachings of the wild, particularly in when Buddhism met Taoism in China and turned into Chan and Zen practice. Many of you may be familiar with the poetry, the paintings, the stories, and so much that can be inspired by those teachings. Now, a few years ago, I showed Gil Fronsdale, who I think many of you know, the write-up for a nature retreat I was giving, and asked for his feedback. And he said, he read it and he said, well, there's one thing I want to comment on. And I thought, oh no, you know, what might this be? What did I do wrong? kind of feeling. He said, well, you wrote in there that practice in nature can be a powerful addition to our regular practice. And then he said, actually, for the Buddha, meditating in nature is the regular practice. Because for the 40 years that the Buddha practiced, most of that was outdoors. It was in nature. It was under trees. It was in parks. And you may be familiar that one of his most favorite instructions was, go to the forest and sit at the root of a tree. Gil also shared with me a quote from the Buddha that goes, as long as there are practitioners who delight in living in the forest at the root of trees, the ways of the awakened ones will not decline. So I like to think that this encouragement, this possibility, this direction of encouraging us to be outdoors, to bring our Dharma practice, our mindfulness, to being with the greater community of beings is really going back to the root of the Dharma, the root of the Buddhist teaching. And it's kind of a revitalization of that basic teaching. It was later that the monasteries and the institutions were created. And it was in the 19th century, actually, that the Thai forest tradition was created in a similar response. And the Thai forest tradition is a major influence on insight meditation movement in the US today, where many of the monks went back to the forest to learn what they could learn in that relationship. So there's that origin, and then there's also the question of American culture. Because I think there's a unique expression of this now arising in American culture, and I'm talking about, for primarily what I would call the more modern, contemporary Euro-American culture. There's a lot of diversity in this culture. And it would take a longer conversation to bring it all together. But I do want to say that in America, we've had a long history, I would say, of a great love of nature and the outdoors, actually unlike some other cultures. And there's been a history of artists and poets and writers and explorers who have expressed that. There's also, of course, the native peoples here who have and continue to have, despite, I don't think genocide is actually too strong a word, despite the great destruction of those cultures, but the native peoples continue often to have a very deep and profound relationship with the earth. That I think, despite the history, has rubbed off on us, more Euro-Americans. And I want to say that, you know, we can look at, there's actually been, over time, a development in the last couple hundred years of what I call homegrown American mystics. And many of these are not Buddhist per se, but you can, sometimes they have connection to it, but are really, if you look at them, are often nature mystics. And in this category, we have Thoreau and Emerson. We have our wonderful Californian Muir, John Muir, who said, "The clearest way into the universe is through a forest wilderness." We have contemporary, one of my favorite, what I call a contemporary nature mystic, is Mary Oliver. And I would say also what's emerged, not only in the U.S., you know, but in other cultures, as well, other Western or other cultures as well, but a lot in the U.S. in the last 20 years or so, are movements of deep ecology, movements of ecofeminism, movements of ecopsychology. And if you're familiar with these, they actually have a deep mystical, spiritual underpinnings as well. So I would argue that there is a uniquely American, in some way, draw or longing or calling to understand our place in the greater natural world, to come to a kind of integration, a kind of wholeness. And I, of course, at the same time, we're involved in all kinds of ways of being disconnected and destroying that. So in comes Buddhism, which has become a huge influence in, well, to us it's a huge influence. I don't know if the rest of America thinks so, but it's certainly been more and more of an influence in our culture. And there's been a what I call a sub-movement in American Dharma, where American teachers are taking the Dharma into the wild. And I know people in all three of the major traditions, Zen and Tibetan and Theravada, that are doing this. So there's other things can I say, but one thing I guess I'll just say right now is I'm sort of setting this context, or I don't know, giving a little historical or current context for continued, maybe something you're not so familiar with. Simply put, you know, what does this practice in the wild look like? It can look very simple, from going out. I live in the Redwoods, and it may mean just in the morning sitting on my back deck among the Redwoods and doing my meditation there. It may be walking, you know, outside. It may mean doing my Qigong or Tai Chi practice outdoors. It may be mean just a simple walk on the beach or through the woods, but in a in an attitude of openness and presence and mindfulness. It may mean actually attending a retreat where you sit and walk and are given instructions on how to practice mindfulness, but also how to let nature teach you the deepest Dharma teachings. So what I want to say, I guess, here is that in some way, and this is where it becomes my passion and my mission, that I can argue that this profound understanding of our place in the universe and a fully connected and interconnected way is really the missing piece in our modern lives, the missing piece in society, the missing piece in politics, the missing piece in our psyche, and in some ways the missing piece in Dharma. And in addressing the fundamental suffering and confusion in the world, and really, really finding what it means to have the ability to live fully and openly and responsively in the world that we are a part of. I guess I just wanted to say that when I began to really, I had some teachers who pioneered some of this Dharma wilderness practice. And when I began doing more of that practice, even though Buddha Dharma is really the heart of my life, I have to say there is a way in which it became more fully alive, more fully real, where the barriers and the limitations of a lot of the human or ego-centered way really became challenged and began falling away. And where the heart of the practice, the really being able to open to the to really all sentient beings became real and not just a nice dedication or prayer. I was a practicing psychotherapist for many years, and I became very interested in what's called eco-psychology. And this is a little description of that. At the heart of eco-psychology is the concept of eco-alienation, the belief that the wound to our psyche and spirit caused by humankind's estrangement from the natural world impairs us profoundly on every level of being, from the most personal to the planetary. Thus, we cannot adequately treat the individual or society without understanding and addressing the largest context from which our suffering arises. So Buddhism says that the largest context or the way of understanding the root of our suffering comes from our habit of grasping onto what cannot be grasped. And that this habit of grasping and identifying and so forth originates in the delusion of a separate self and in ignorance. And really what ignorance means in the Buddhist context is not being in touch with the truth of reality, not being in touch with the direct experience of reality, not knowing who and what we really are, not understanding the most fundamental laws of Dharma. So it is my experience, practice in nature. Of course, all our practice is wonderful. All the ways we meditate and the different practices we do and the retreats we do and the teachings we get in the Buddha Dharma are leading towards greater and greater freedom and understanding of these. But I'm just saying, I want to emphasize that my experience of practicing in nature can cut through and bring us to a much more immediate and direct and full way to seeing our habits of grasping, to seeing through the delusion of a separate self, and to actually connect with what might be called our true nature. And some traditions actually call enlightenment our natural state. Another way of talking about it is, you could say that our suffering arises from living in states of disconnection and fragmentation. And that our Dharma practice is really the practice of coming back into wholeness and connection. I'm going to read you a quote which I've become very enamored of. I get quotes that I'm enamored of for a while. And this was actually, it's in the recent Tricycle magazine in the letter from the editor, from one of the editors, Andrew Cooper. It's not about nature practice in general, but it speaks to what I'm pointing to here. Although E.M. Forster could hardly have intended that the epigraph to his novel, Howard's End, only connect, serve as the two-word distillation of the Buddha's teaching, it certainly is a good and timely one, to connect across the differences that divide us, to connect by building bonds of affection, understanding, and support, to connect in the recognition that we in all things are well connected. In our age of accelerated travel and instant communication, doesn't the simple phrase offer us a promising touchstone for Buddhist practice? Is not connection with others one of the surest ways to loosen the bonds of self-concern and to find one's best way to act in the world? Is it as well a wonderfully economical description of the basis, the means, and the fruit of the Buddha way? Our differences do indeed matter, but they don't matter as much as this. Only connect. Only connect. And in Forster's words, live in fragments no more. So again, I have found, as a summary of more and more going into nature, what I call going into nature in a sacred way, of course we discover as we are nature, there is no distinction, and we discover my experience is really what it means to only connect, and really what it means to live in fragments no more. So, I want to say a few more things about how this can affect us on different levels. And hopefully have a little time for some question and answers or comments or whatever. So one way I'm going to go from perhaps the grossest level to the most subtle. So the grossest level is how this needs to impact us and can impact us on the global and planetary level, and how we can begin to act in the world as if we are interconnected, which we are. Because obviously the world is now falling apart from this a deep fragmentation and not understanding that when we abuse each other, we abuse ourselves. When we abuse nature, we abuse ourselves. And yet this is a basic teaching of all Buddhists, and I saw all wisdom teachings, and it's a basic teaching of ecology as well. That we can begin to actually see and know, and not from here, but see and know and live from the direct the direct realization of the ongoing interconnectedness and interdependence of all things. And many of you are probably familiar with the teachings of Thich Nhat Hanh, and this is one of his favorite teachings, which he calls interbeing. And this is from Thich Nhat Hanh. And he says, if you are a poet, you will clearly see that there is a cloud floating in this sheet of paper. And without a cloud, there would be no rain. Without rain, the trees cannot grow. And without trees, we cannot make paper. The cloud is essential for the paper to exist. If the cloud is not there, the sheet of paper is not here either. And if we look into this sheet of paper more deeply, we see the sunshine in it. And if the sunshine is not there, the forest cannot grow. In fact, nothing grows. Even we cannot grow without sunshine. So we know sunshine is in the paper. And looking more deeply, we see that we are in it too. That it is not difficult to see, because when we look at a sheet of paper, the sheet of paper is part of our perception. You can say that everything is in here, in this sheet of paper. You cannot point to one thing that is not here: time, space, earth, rain, minerals, sunshine, the cloud, the river, the heat. Everything coexists with this sheet of paper. And I want to say in the beginning, he says, if you are a poet. But I also say, if you are a deep Dharma practitioner, you don't just understand that as poetry. You don't understand that as a beautiful idea. You understand that as reality. And that's my mission, is to provide people the experience to actually know this in the depth of their heart, to see it, to realize it, to be it, not to just understand it conceptually. On one of my month-long meditation retreats, solo retreats, this is just something simple I wrote afterwards. This was high in the mountains in Colorado. Watching the 14,000-foot snow cap above me slowly melt into the frigid Wild River below, sitting through rain and hailstorms that fed into that stream, and drinking that river over many days, I wonder, am I the snow, the stream, the rain? What am I? So we begin this real path from the egocentric view of the world, from this small, limited view of me and my safety and what I get and what I want and what I don't want, to actually a profound view, what's sometimes called the ecocentric view. And again, we begin to live actually from an alive and open and undivided and connected place, and beyond these limits of this small self. And isn't that what the Dharma teaches? And faced with the destruction and suffering on a global level that we see, isn't this the wisdom that we need to change? This is from poet Gary Lawless. When the animals come to us asking for our help, will we know what they are saying? When the plants speak to us in their delicate, beautiful language, will we be able to answer them? When the planet herself sings to us in our dreams, will we be able to wake ourselves and act? I think the world is asking us to wake up and act from an enlightened, free, and compassionate place. So we can be transformed, you might say, or wake up on so many levels in our Dharma practice in general, and again, from the teachings of the wild. And we can begin to actually heal the disconnectedness of our own psyche and body as well, not just with the planet. We can begin to actually be connected to the nature that is called our body. There's a huge disease of disconnection happening in the world, people not actually feeling, knowing, being alive in their body, and all the health and distress and stress that comes from that, being disconnected from our emotions and aliveness, being out of balance in so many ways, being locked in our addictions to activities, to what I call speed and greed. In our practice in nature, I have found personally and with other people, it begins to actually reconnect us on the most fundamental level of just this heart and mind and body. And we can learn to breathe and relax and move at the speed of life instead of the speed of computers and the craziness of our own addictions and mind. And we can also begin, one way I often teach in working, being in nature is merely opening up and actually seeing the Buddha's teachings revealed around us in the natural world. They're being revealed right now in this room. You don't have to technically do that, go out into a wild setting. But it's so real and obvious and immediate and uncluttered and unconfused. And we can separate ourselves with what are sometimes called the weapons of mass distraction so that we can actually see simply what's right in front of us. And we can see the truth of impermanence. You know, some Theravada teachers say that enlightenment comes from just the direct understanding and knowing of impermanence. And that flow of reality of birth and death is so obvious and so real and so poignant when we pay attention. And we learn presence and non-separation and connectedness. And this is from the great Thai forest teacher Ajahn Chah. Trees and vines can all reveal the true nature of reality. With wisdom, there is no need to question anyone, no need to study. We can learn from nature everything to be enlightened. And that takes us to what I would call the deepest level here, which is the hardest one to talk about. And I'll just say a little bit, because we're coming to the end of our time. The most subtle and deep level of our practice in general, and also of what's available if you really open to the way of nature or the teachings of the natural world. And this I would call direct communion with truth. Direct communion with what is. Directly knowing who and what we are at the most profound level. And this is from the Tao Te Ching. Empty yourself of everything. Let the mind rest at peace. The 10,000 things rise and fall while the self watches their return. They grow and flourish and return to the source. Returning to the source is stillness, which is the way of nature. The way of nature is unchanging. One of my nature teachers talked about the essence of practice of returning to source, which is really the same as the experience of Nibbana, the taste of liberation and freedom. And at the most advanced levels of our practice, we have to leave behind everything. As this says, free yourself of everything. And that means of our ideas and our concepts and our knowledge and our beliefs and our books and our strategies and our explanations and our comforts and our crutches and all our false identities. And even our practices. In my experiences, when you go into nature, that is supported, and that we can drop into the release and the directness of experience. The real connection, the real direct knowing, the ultimate realization that brings freedom and liberation and peace. Well, I'm just debating how to end now. Maybe I'll read you two things. Then there'll be a few minutes. Actually, I think I'll just read this because it's a description of a woman on a wilderness retreat and the transforming or awakening experience she had. During a wilderness retreat, a woman was visited regularly by hummingbirds whirring and dancing through the air. At least once a day, the largest of the hummers would stop in midair, 2 or 3 feet in front of her forehead, and hover there for a few seconds, looking at her. She soon felt that the little hummers, in quotes, had stolen her heart away. And triggered in her, in quotes, a profound sense of humility, respect, and joy. As she gazed out over the vast valley view from her sacred site, reflection on, in quotes, their vulnerability wrenched her heart. And the thought of the destruction of their winter home in the rainforest was, in quotes, almost unbearable. That night, in a state, in quotes, where the boundary had dissolved between waking and sleeping, she felt as though her mind was, in quotes, floating in the mind of nature. And she felt that, in quote, sense of infinite being and the bursting open of her heart. So let's end this formal part with a little bit of silence, and then we have a little bit of time for comments or questions.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.